Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is historian and author, Dr. Emma Southen. This is episode CLXI, Syrian Matriarchy. The Severan dynasty was founded in 193 CE by Septimius Severus, but in many ways, it was his wife Julia Domna and her sister, Julia Maessa, who would go on to guide the family. Both powerful Augusti, they were instrumental in securing their family's imperial position. Here's Emma Southen.
So we are moving out of the Antonine period with the death of Commodus at the end of the 2nd century, and then moving into the 3rd century, which is when everything starts to go a bit wonky, really wonky at the top of Roman politics, and we start to properly see military emperors. There is a war at the end of the death of Commodus that Septimius Severus wins, largely by being cleverer than everybody else. He is a Libyan Roman senator. His mother is Italian, who moves to Libya. He grows up in Libya, goes back to Rome, becomes a senator, becomes a general, and then outsmarts everybody when there is this power vacuum in the wake of Commodus, and kind of manipulates everybody into either standing aside or joining his side. And he takes the throne and convincingly holds it, partly because he has a lovely young wife and two sons, which is super useful for setting up dynasty, which is what Romans always want to see. They want to see that there's going to be stability in the future, that this isn't going to be a one-off guy.
Yeah, of course. This is really a massive change for Rome, because this is the furthest away an emperor has been from, if I can call it that way. They've had Roman emperors from Spain. Hello, Trajan. Hello, Hadrian.
Yep.
But this is really kind of the far-flung reaches of the empire as far as they're concerned, where he's come from.
This is Africa, which obviously they consider to be both extremely far away and extremely foreign. Therefore, the greatest compliment that they repeatedly pay to Septimius and to other members of his family is how Roman he is and how un-African he is. And when they're writing flattering letters about him, they repeatedly say, it's like you're more Roman than the most Roman Roman. They do tease him a bit for his accent, because Latin is not his first language. He probably has Greek as a first language, but he is constantly complimented, and he tries really, really hard, as does his wife Domna, to be as traditionally Roman as they possibly can in order to overcome the fact that they are not from Northern Europe or Southern Europe.
But it's very much the senators hold their nose and make him the emperor. All right, so can we now segue to Syria and talk about the Julias, who are the focus of this episode, and very interesting ladies.
They are. So we have two sisters who are Julia Domna and Julia Maessa. Maessa is the older and Domna is the younger. They are from a Roman Arabic family, probably a Roman Arabic royal family, because Syria has been kind of absorbed in a strange way into the Roman Empire. Bits of it remain largely independent. They have their own rulers. They're from Emesa, which is now Oms. And Emesa becomes a very big city, partly because it's on a really important trade route coming up from sub-Saharan Africa into the Mediterranean. So they make a lot of money on taxes. And also they have a really big temple there to Elagabalus, who is a big stone, a big black stone that is a really important god who may or may not be related to the sun, but it is a point of a focus of worship, and pilgrims come from all over the Greek East in order to worship at this temple. And the two Julias, their father is the priest of this temple. He's the head priest. And so they come from a prominent but very provincial family. They are very prominent in Syria and in Emesa, but their influence doesn't go any further than that, until Septimius Severus comes through one day sees Domna and likes her, apparently, because a few years later, when his wife dies, he decides he's going to go back to Syria, pick up this young woman and take her to Gaul with him. And she suddenly goes from being a young girl who probably would have had a perfectly good provincial life as a upper class, prominent, rich Syrian woman into being the wife of a senator who quite swiftly afterwards becomes a contender for the throne and then wins the throne. And she, over a period of just a few years, gets whisked from this local politics into the very heights of imperial politics.
So the Historia Augusta has a nice convenient prophecy, doesn't it, about all of this?
It does.
Which is possibly an invention in retrospect once Septimius Severus becomes the emperor.
90% of the Historia Augusta is probably... The Historia Augusta is a real pain for this period because you so badly want it to be useful, but it's so wrong on so many things that you can't really trust it at any point. Like, it spends a lot of time thinking that Caracalla is not Julia Domna's son, and it repeatedly says that Julia Domna is his stepmother, which she definitely isn't. Like, she's definitely his biological mother, and it just makes like terrible mistakes like that all the time. But it says about Severus that he consulted his horoscopes in order to find a woman who had a horoscope that said she would be queen, basically. Domna's horoscope came up, so he picked her as...
Right.
But it's kind of a way of saying that he's both superstitious and also power hungry, because he chooses a woman who will guarantee his pathway to the throne rather than for any other more reasonable reason, like the fact that she's from a good family or something.
Right. Okay, so they get married 4th of February, 187. So that makes her 17 years old. She has Bassianus a year later and Geta a year later than that.
Yep. They presumably never have sex again because that's the end of her having babies. She does her duty. They are living a happy life, living in Gaul. Severus is a general marching about, making sure that everybody's behaving themselves until 192 when... Commodus dies and everything kicks off.
Sudden scene cut to Rome.
Yeah.
And at this point, Maesa is with them living in Rome, like an imperial kind of sitcom extended family at that point.
They are. So one of the main things that Severus does is he elevates Libyan and Syrian men and women to imperial positions. So Maesa and her husband, Avitus, he's an equestrian. He's suddenly raised right up into the echelons of imperial politics. And so is Maesa along with him. Severus really puts a lot of energy into bringing Syrian and Libyan people into Roman politics and to building up Lepus Magna as well. And they benefit from that. Interestingly, he gives Avitus a lot of positions, but never lets him have any power in a way that suggests he doesn't really trust him. Whenever he gives him a province, it's a province that doesn't have an army.
Yeah, we've got his a memorial stone to him, don't we? I think it's in like Croatia it was found. And I remember reading about this going, oh, okay, he's the high priest for the cult of Titus. Sure,
yeah.
Cool.
So it's always it's a good position, but it's never a great position. And he gives him...
It's not like Augustus or anything.
Yeah, and never anything where he could gather any power. And my personal headcanon on this is that he doesn't trust Maesa, because Julia Maesa goes with him everywhere. And later we will see why you might not want to trust her if given access to an army. He doesn't trust them not to use it against him later.
That could be very well the case. So what do we know of Julia Domna during this time? Septimius Severus does a lot of campaigning.
Yep.
Julia Domna does go with him.
Pretty much all the time. She is almost always with him. She is mother of the camps, which is an epithet that he gives her. A mother of the soldiers, and she is both extremely well behaved and super useful to him. She is a very good Roman wife in the Livia tradition of doing patronage and standing back and rarely causing any kind of scandal. The only unlikely thing she does is she develops this circle of philosophers around her, and she patronizes them and commissions books.
That is an admirable activity, I think.
It is an admirable activity. Lives of philosophers and things like that. But she is very into philosophy and into patronizing philosophers and writers who like to think about hard things. Philostratus says that she has this kind of literary circle around her, that her court is primarily thinkers and philosophers. Considered to be a good thing, because at least it's not, you know, flatterers and other women, which would be terrible. And this is all part of how Roman they consider her to be. They try to paint her very hard, and she behaves very much as a very traditional Roman wife and a very traditional Roman mother who is engaged with her children's career.
Yeah.
In no way does she ever particularly play up her Syrianness and the fact that she is an Arab woman.
It's interesting that you say that this shows how Roman she is, because it sounds more Greek to me.
It is quite Greek.
And I wonder if that kind of reflected with her upbringing.
That's definitely
her. It's closer to Greece, yeah.
She's in the Greek East. Her first languages are probably Greek and Aramaic. And yeah. Greek is going to be her primary kind of culture.
The other big scene that Julia Domna gets is once her husband Septimius Severus dies in 211, and Caracalla and Geta, her sons, become the emperors, is at Geta's death scene. Geta is killed in her arms.
Yeah. So Caracalla and Geta are only a year apart in age, and they hate each other violently. But Septimius Severus has spent his entire imperial career desperately trying to get them to get along, because what he wants is to give the empire to them as joint co-emperors in the vein of Marcus Aurelius and Lucius Verus. And so that's his aim. As soon as he dies, which he does in York, actually, in England, they immediately talk about splitting the empire, because they know they can't govern together. Like, the first discussion they have is, well, if you went east and I went west, then, and that's the first time you get a conversation about splitting the empire in half. Domna convinces them not to do this and says, you know, you may as well split me in half, because how am I going to spend time with both of you? So they agree that they're going to work together, and for a few months they sort of do, in that they release coins and stuff with Concordia and whatever on them while they're refusing to even be in the same house together. Caracalla, being the more violent of the two and certainly the more dominant, comes up with a plan to murder Geta, falls apart immediately, and so he ends up bursting into the sitting room where Geta and his mother are sitting and stabbing Geta to death while Domna holds him, and then storming back out again, which is a really dramatic scene, and leaves Domna in this position where she has just literally watched one son murder the other, but now she only has one son left.
The subject of many dramatic Renaissance paintings as well.
It is.
That as a result of this, I mean, the main mentions that we kind of get of her are that she's prevented from mourning.
Yeah. So Caracalla is not a particularly nice person. He's quite handsome, but he's not very nice, to put it politely. His immediate reaction is to prevent mourning. He says, you know, Geta was killed for a reason. We're not going to mourn him. Damnatio memoriae. And gets annoyed with his mother whenever she tries to be sad about it. Domna, whether you want to say this is to her credit or not, she has the option of kind of retiring from everything and wandering off and living a private life in the way that maybe Octavia did when her son died. But what she does is she leans in really hard to Caracalla's reign instead, and she becomes effectively his right-hand woman.
Really?
Yeah. So she goes everywhere with Caracalla. Caracalla gets really annoyed with the Senate after about 20 minutes and goes off to spend as much time with the army as he possibly can. He loves the army. The army love him. He is one of those emperors, one of those generals who is down the front with the men, having a laugh round the fire. He's not a general who sits in a tent or wears fancy clothing. He is a soldier at heart, really. He doesn't like women, divorces his wife at like 14, and then never marries again. Domna is there basically doing the work with him. She does all his correspondence. She is his handler, effectively, and she goes everywhere with him. Where Caracalla is, Domna is.
This sounds like she's effectively still the Empress.
Kind of, yeah. Because she is doing a lot of the day-to-day stuff while he is off trying to fight a German somewhere.
Mm. So Caracalla dies in a ditch on the side of the road.
He's killed while having a poo.
Yeah, okay. All right.
It's cheap. That's the most vulnerable time they can find him. Because he hangs out with soldiers, it also makes him very accessible to soldiers, and he is killed by a soldier who is annoyed at him over a promotion.
Very sadly, Julia Domna commits suicide at this point.
She does a few months later. So he's killed and overthrown by a guy called Macrinus, who is a soldier, and he is not particularly good at politics in the way that he lets the entire family keep living. So whereas mostly when there has been a coup, they'll eliminate the whole family because they don't want any other bloodlines. And you're about to find out why you tend to eliminate the entire family if you're doing a coup. He lets Domna live. He kind of takes away a lot of her privileges, and she's no longer the Augusta. She's in Antioch at this point, and he says, you can go back to Emesa, you can live your life, but she's kind of lost everything. All her kids are dead. Her husband's dead. She's been at the very top, and now she faces the prospect of just going back to her dad's house, essentially. So she starves herself to death instead.
Yeah, that's really rough going.
It is rough going. She has a real roller coaster of a life. Like, it really does go from mediocre to the very top, and then just a series of terrible things happen as it just kind of tails off towards the end.
What is Maessa up to during all of this? So while Septimius Severus is the emperor, Maessa and I guess her husband and family are living it up in Rome.
They are. So they've spent 20 years in Rome. She's had two daughters who've had good marriages and have had their own children. Severus doesn't let his immediate family come to Rome because they talk with funny accents. There's a good story about his sister. He meets up with his sister while he is in Antioch, I think, and his sister embarrasses him by being too provincial and not being able to speak Latin well enough. She's a pleb in the imperial court, so he just sends her home again and then never speaks of her again. So he never brings his family. So the only imperial family is Domna's family, who fit right in, and they are able to build around themselves a huge amount of power and wealth and popularity, really. They're not unpopular by any means. And when Caracalla dies, they are sent back to Emesa. They get to take pretty much everything they have with them, anything that they can move, but it is still a far cry from being at the center of the universe as they were when they were in Rome, and having the amount of power and the amount of money that they had there. Maessa, it seems, does not take lightly to being sent back. Unlike her younger sister, who kind of wastes away, Maessa has two kids. She's got a bunch of grandkids, and she has a whole lot of ambition to get back to Rome. And what she does is Dio says that is her kind of de facto husband. She's widowed about the same time as Severus dies. And she has this guy who she has raised, who's one of her like foster kids, called Gannis. And Dio, he says this is Gannis's doing and that Maessa didn't know anything about it. But everyone else says that it was Maessa's doing and nobody else's. So you can take your pick on who you want to say. But what they do is there is a legion just outside of Emesa, and that legion comes in and out of Emesa a lot. They worship at the temple, and that temple is where Maessa's grandson, who we know as Elagabalus, is the head priest. And he looks freakishly like Caracalla.
And when you say it's a local legion, they're all local boys, aren't they?
Exactly. Yeah. They're not.
So they're the lads who signed up. They're not from Italy.
They're not from Italy. They've never been to Italy. They're local lads who come in and know the family and who are already quite into them. And Caracalla is popular. The Senate and the people who are in charge of talking about people's legacies, hate him, but the soldiers adore him. So Maesa convinces the legion, with a bit of dressing up Elagabalus and a little bit of giving them lots of money, that Elagabalus is the biological illegitimate son of Caracalla.
Mm.
And that he is therefore the rightful emperor, not Macrinus. And nobody particularly knows who Macrinus is, and no one has any particular loyalty to him, so they go with it. And they take Elagabalus to the legions, and the legions mutiny and send off a message to Macrinus, who's in Antioch, and say, "You're not the emperor anymore, according to us. This kid is. He's 14 at this time."
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is an escalation. And so there's a bit of a war, and they go and besiege Antioch and chase Macrinus out and then keep marching. They declare him emperor, and eventually Maesa and her daughter and her grandson, Elagabalus, sweep back into Rome and say, "Hello, we're back."
That must have been quite the scene.
Never thought we'd see you again.
Never thought we'd see you again. Yeah. And suddenly here you are again with the new emperor in tow.
Yeah.
When you've got a 14-year-old boy as emperor, it's easy to see that, you know, he's in charge
mm-hmm.
in name only.
He does still have that power. Like, he is still the one who signs the documents. You have this strange situation whereby everybody wants to say that Maesa is really in charge, but at the same time want to list off all of the bad stuff that Elagabalus is doing, like changing the religion. He brings the Elagabal stone to Rome and tries to convince people to worship this. He refuses to take the name of Pontifex Maximus and will only call himself the priest of Elagabal, which is why we call him Elagabalus. He marries Vestal virgins. He's married 5 times in a very short period. He clearly does still have the power to do whatever the hell he wants, and either his mother and grandmother have no interest in controlling him, or they are completely unable to control him and they are forced to kind of sit back. And they do engage with the Senate and with the running of the empire and making sure that there are still governors being sent to places where they need to be governors and people being paid in a way that has never been seen before. They are the only people, as far as we know, the only women who go into the Senate.
Right.
This bit of Dio is really fragmentary, which is annoying. But one of the sentences that you get is that he's talking about Elagabalus adopting his cousin. He says, "Maesa and Soemias took their normal places on either side of Elagabalus in the Senate."
Like Agrippina style.
Yeah, but even Agrippina didn't go into the Senate. She would like sit behind a curtain. But they are going in and sitting in the Senate House, a place where women are not supposed to set foot, which is full defiling, really, of this masculine space. And
I imagine Dio would have had a fair bit to say about that as well.
Unfortunately, it's all lost. Yeah. I suspect that he would have had an awful lot to say about that and was quite furious about it. But at the same time, Dio is a beneficiary of Maesa and Maimea. His career is really made by Severus Alexander and by Maimea. So he can't be too horrible about them because he owes them everything.
Yeah. Around this time as well, Maesa gets the title of Grandmother of the Emperor.
Yes.
Which is a nice one. That seems quite unique, I think.
It is. It is. It's a good one. It marks her out as being something, because there isn't really a space for her otherwise, so she makes her own space. There's already a mother of the emperor, which is a traditional position at this point. Elagabalus has 5 wives, which is if any of them stayed around for more than a month and a half, would have been a traditional position. But there's no position for grandmothers, so she just makes her own. She's like, "Well, I'm the grandmother of the emperor, so I will give myself a title."
She's attributed with getting Elagabalus to adopt his cousin. This is Severus Alexander. Do you give her that much agency?
Yes. Like, she's clearly running the family at this point. Elagabalus is running around making whatever laws he wants to make and causing chaos. And his mother is given little to no agency. It's clear that Maesa is the person in charge of the family, which means she's the person in charge of all of the decisions with regards to succession and stuff like that. And Elagabalus is looking dodgy. Nobody likes him. He's refusing to do what everybody else has done, which is be Roman, in inverted commas. He's being as Syrian as he possibly can, and he's wearing dresses, and he's worshipping the wrong gods, and he's worshipping them in a way that the Romans find upsetting, which is, like, loudly. He is convinced to adopt his younger cousin, Severus Alexander, the son of Mamaea, in order to give this illusion of, again, stability and succession, and that this is the Antonines are going to continue on into the next generation. The version goes that when Maesa decided that Elagabalus was too out of control, he was like 18, 19 years old, and he was only getting less easy to control, and there was going to come a point very soon when he was going to stop listening to anybody, that she decides to just get rid of him.
And her daughter.
And her own daughter, yes. He is killed by soldiers in an uprising where they take Severus Alexander to the Praetorian camp and say, come on, lads, let's get rid of this guy. They are stabbed to death, holding on to each other.
Mm.
A lot of this family end up with knives in there while clinging on to their mothers.
It's quite a brutal thing to do to your own family.
She comes across as incredibly ruthless in this kind of thing, but because of the sources that we've got, the only scenes where she appears are things where she's doing something really dramatic, like saying that her grandson is the illegitimate son of Caracalla, which is basically saying my daughter slept with her cousin and had a baby. Not the kind of thing you normally go around saying about your daughter. And then when it looks like he is endangering her, she then says, oh no, get rid of him. So she only appears when she's doing something very, very dramatic, which makes her feel like someone who's incredibly ruthless, who will do anything for power and to maintain her position that she loves more than she loves her own children and grandchildren.
Yeah, because none of this is about family, if we take these accounts. It's all about power, which she would have a hard time exerting anyway.
Yeah.
So when Severus Alexander becomes the emperor, is he a bit more pliable to her ways?
He comes across as a real sweetheart. He's, again, about 14 when he becomes emperor, and he is a real pliable, sweet little kid who just wants to make his mum happy. Maesa, by this time, is a lot older, and she kind of retreats during Severus's reign, largely because Mamaea is elevated above her. Alexander really loves his mum, and he gives her everything that he can possibly give her. He gives her the title Mother of the Whole Human Race, which is a title
good
that
enough.
I really like.
Yeah, that's the Roman equivalent of I love you to the moon and back.
Exactly. So that's put, like, stamped on a coin. She really takes precedence over Maesa, and she doesn't come across particularly well, obviously, because she's a woman in Roman politics. Herodian thinks that she just wants money, which is a fairly traditional thing to say about women with power. But she sort of overshadows Maesa to a large extent. And you can see that in the coinage as well. When you look at the kind of percentage of coins which are being produced with each woman on them during the reigns, the ones with Maesa's face on really kind of drop off during Severus's reign.
Kind of you would expect, though, considering, you know, how many grandmothers of the emperor get on coins regularly?
Very few. It's interesting to me because I think that it potentially says something to the personalities of her daughters, where Suemia seems to be the Severus Alexander of the two, where she will allow herself to be overridden to a certain extent by her mother. And she doesn't really do anything. Like, in all of the sources, you never really see her do or say anything, which means she's probably just well-behaved in that she doesn't start any coups. But Mamaea doesn't allow her mother to tell her what to do. She's the daughter who wants to stand up to her mom and say, no, I am the mother of the emperor. Mm. You get out of the way a little bit. I am the one who will be his regent.
And we get a vague death for Maesa.
It is. She dies very much off stage. at some point in a 2-year period, she just... And the only reason that we're pretty sure she dies is that she stops appearing on coins altogether.
Oh, right. That's what it's down to.
Yeah. Between 224 and 227. She is deified. which is good for her because you don't often see women who genuinely held some kind of significant position. So many of them end up dying in horrible ways and then not getting deification. It's always the most bland women that end up being deified. So it doesn't really stick around for that long because of what happens in the late 3rd century. But she does get to die at really the height of her power and to get the honours that she deserved.
Yeah, okay, went out on top. and her daughter dies horribly in the knife on the back thing that you were alluding to before. At that point, Maximinus Thrax.
Yeah.
And soon after that, lots of civil wars, etc. So did this dynasty and these women make Rome rethink what it meant to be somebody from the outer provinces? Because before, when Romans talked about, you know, women from those kind of areas, you've got Cleopatra, you've got Berenice, they're hated,
yeah,
they're despised in the sources. But this sort of thing is very different.
It is a big change. It very much feels like this is a point where Rome kind of opens itself up to the Greek and Arabic East in a way that it hasn't previously. And partly this is because with Trajan's expansions, a lot of people who lost their provincial positions moved into Rome and started moving into the Roman power structures, which allowed for Romans to start seeing people from the East as people rather than stereotypes or enemies, and to start seeing them as part of the empire. Severus and Domna and their descendants are able to bring more and more people by elevating Lepus Magna and Antioch and Palmyra and make those places where things happen rather than places which are far away. And it forces everybody in Rome to look at the East in a way that they haven't before, and not something that they conquered and which is full of people over there, but as a place where really important things happen and which is part of the empire. And that's a long process. It takes some time, but this is the first time that you get to see that really in action.
I kind of see this entire dynasty as being the most powerful that we see Roman women get, definitely up until this point with the imperial lines.
Mm-hmm.
But the entire dynasty is very much controlled and guided by women. And while in the Antonine dynasty, you had women as the links, it was essentially the daughters who carried through the imperial lines through the adoptions there. Here it's women deciding who becomes emperor almost. If you want to start from the prophecy,
yeah,
with Julia Domna, right through to Maesa pulling all the strings.
Yeah, this dynasty is the point, largely because this is the first time that you see minor emperors, not grown men, but children, 13, 14-year-old children. Like, they just don't have the ability to command a Senate or command an army. So they have their mothers doing it for them. What this dynasty really is, it is a second Julian dynasty, because Severus contributes nothing. All he does is bring Domna and her family to Rome, and then they proceed to have children and rule alongside or for their children. It's not really a Severan dynasty. It's the Julias and their kids. I think it's much more usefully or much more interestingly looked at like that than seeing them as Severans.
The other thing, I suppose, about this, in this series of podcasts that I've been working on, I've been talking about wives, but here I'm just pretty much plainly talking about mothers, grandmothers.
You know,
like it's a whole matriarchy kind of thing for this dynasty.
And that is a different power, because a mother has so much more influence over her children than a wife can ever have over her husband. Because a wife can be got rid of, but unless you go Nero, you can't get rid of a mother.
That's Dr. Emma Southen, historian and author, and her most recent book is called A Fatal Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. And you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Please leave a review. They are always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow us both on Twitter. Emma is at Nuclear Teeth, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, I will be joined by Rhiannon Evans, Kaelin Davenport, and Darius Aria as we record our anthology of interest. But until then, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.